call the Government Operations Reform Technology and Elections Committee to order. And with that, we're going to reverse the presentation today and have the legislative auditor come up.
And welcome to the committee, and would you identify yourself for the record, and then I think I'll turn it over to you to proceed in the order that you wish on the evaluation of the pension.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman and members of the committee. My name is Jim Nobles. I'm the legislative auditor of the state of Minnesota. I recall that 34 years ago, this committee was considering a piece of legislation that was very important to the financial operations of the state of Minnesota. You had before you the recommendations of the Loaned Executive Action Program, which was a group of executives from both the public and private sectors that had made an extensive study of the state of Minnesota's financial operations, and they made two key recommendations. Number one, that the state should modernize and professionalize its financial operations by creating a Department of Finance. Before that time, the budget and financial affairs of the state were run out of the Department of Administration, and LEAP, the Loan Executive Action Program, thought that the state's financial affairs had become large enough and complicated enough that it needed its own department and to be modernized and professionalized. And this committee considered that legislation and approved it. The other key recommendation of the Loaned Executive Action Program concerning the state's financial operations was that the legislative branch should be responsible for the audit function in state government and create a nonpartisan professional audit office, the Office of the Legislative Auditor, and take that function out of the executive branch where it was with a public examiner who was appointed by the governor. And again, this committee passed that legislation, and here I am in front of you today. Minnesota was also involved later in another important reform of governmental financial affairs when the state of Minnesota joined with the Council of State Governments, the Conference of State Legislatures, the National Association of Auditors, Controllers, and Treasurers, and supported the creation of the Government Accounting Standards Board. Prior to mid-1980s, there really were no uniform, generally accepted accounting principles for government, and that had really created significant problems. Some of you may recall that back in the 70s, some governments, some states, and major cities in the United States had serious financial problems and could not stand behind their debt. And the major financial institutions in this country, and particularly the credit rating agencies, said to state and local governments, we have a problem. You need to clean up your house, your financial affairs. You need to establish a uniform, generally accepted set of accounting principles so we can rigorously examine your financial operations, your financial condition, and give you a fair, objective credit rating. And so the Government Accounting Standards Board was created to establish generally accepted accounting principles for government, or a GAAP for government. GASB, this board, as it is known, produces these standards. And we're going to talk about some of those today because they're quite relevant to the evaluation that we just conducted. GASB has always been concerned about full and fair disclosure of government's financial debt in particular. Obviously, they have rules on recognition of revenue, many other things. They have specific rules on pensions. Those have been in effect for a number of years. And they also have some new rules that we're going to talk about that deal with disclosure concerning other post-employment benefits. So in other words, they've had rules on how you disclose about pension obligations, and now they're moving even a little further into some of the other obligations that government takes on, specifically for health care benefits. What you're going to hear today is that Minnesota is not compliant with one of the key standards of GASB concerning pensions. In Minnesota, we have a post-employment fund that pools all of the resources from various funds when an individual retires. So when a public employee retires, we take money out of the plan where they were as an active employee, and we pool those assets in the post-retirement fund that is invested by the State Board of Investment. This is not a separate retirement plan. It is simply a pooling of assets. The problem we have is that the Pension Commission has a requirement that the actuary that does the valuations of those assets, the Pension Commission has a requirement that those assets will be valued equal to the liabilities. That is not compliant with GASB. GASB, the Government Accounting Standards Board that produces these standards for government, says those assets ought to have a valuation that is market related. In other words, a valuation that shows the reality of what the value of those assets actually is at some point in time. We believe that because of the requirement that is imposed on the actuary by the Pension Commission, there is a masking of a deficit in the post-retirement fund of approximately $4 billion. Obviously, when you're dealing with evaluations and actuarial studies, there is some estimation, but we think a fair estimate of the current deficit in the post fund, which is not now being reported to you, is about $4 billion. There are going to be a lot of important policy issues that you have to face dealing with that deficit, but we think the first step is to put the facts on the table, and that the Pension Commission ought to revise its requirements for the actuary and value those post-retirement assets in an appropriate way, consistent with GASB requirements, in a way that is market-related. We also are going to talk to you this morning about the new requirement for disclosing other post-employment benefits. Jody Hauer was the evaluation manager of this project, and she's going to go through the details of what we found and what we recommend. So at this point, Mr. Chairman, I'd like to turn it over to Ms. Hauer.
Okay. Mr. Nobles, I just have one question. When the Pension Commission changed, I shouldn't say changed, when the requirement was done not to follow GASB, was that a change in policy or was that a standard policy of the Pension Commission? And if there was a change, when did that change occur?
Mr. Chairman, I believe that is the way the Pension Commission has always required it of the actuary, and let me explain for just a minute why. There is a logic behind it. I don't mean to suggest that the Pension Commission is trying to do anything inappropriate. I think it's been something that they put in a place, and it's just simply been overlooked now that we do have a large deficit and it needs to be corrected. The reason they did it the way they do is that when a person comes into retirement out of active membership, the way the system works is that enough assets are put in the post-retirement fund to support that person's annuities, the benefits. So at that point in time, that person's benefits are 100% funded. So if you take that logic for the post-retirement fund, at some point in time, you could say that every person's retirement is fully funded. The problem is that the assets that they took out to fund, let's say, Bill Smith's retirement, those assets are invested in the market. They don't stay static. They change. They go up, they go down. Now, one of the problems that Ms. Hauer is going to talk about is that a number of years ago, the legislature allowed retirees to benefit when the market went up. But they did not require public employees to also have their benefits reduced when the market went down. So the Pension Commission had this policy because on point of retirement, each person's retirement is fully funded. What they failed to do is take account of the fact that those assets will go up and they will go down. And when they go down, you have a deficit. And we think that the first step towards dealing with that problem and good accountability in the governmental sector is to show that in the funding ratio, to show that those assets have been reduced in their current market value, and that ought to be disclosed. So, Mr. Chairman, I don't think it's a change as much as It has historic roots and roots in some logic, but a logic we need to reconsider.
Thank you. Proceed.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members of the committee. My name is Jody Howard. I work for the Legislative Auditor's Office. And this report on post-employment benefits that I'll be describing this morning has two main parts, as Jim Noble has already suggested. One having to do with pensions, the second having to do with other post-employment benefits, which is chiefly retiree health care insurance. I'll start first with the benefits, the pension benefits. Overall, in our work on Minnesota's public pensions, we found some problems related to the post-retirement investment fund. And as you may know, and as Jim Nobles has already described briefly, the post-retirement fund is not a separate retirement plan. It is, instead, a pooling of the assets that come from the statewide pension plans whenever one of their members retires. The post-retirement fund has a $4 billion deficit now as of mid-2006, and I will get into that in a bit more detail in just a moment. We also found problems with the formula that's used to calculate benefit increases for retirees. One problem is that the formula does not protect the post-retirement fund from deficits. And for another thing, the formula does not align well, that is, the benefit increases do not align well with inflation, nor are retirees treated equitably. And I'll get into both of those points, but I'll start first by talking about the deficits. We looked at what's reported to be the financial condition of the statewide pension funds. Those are the ones that are administered by the Public Employees Retirement Association, or PERA, the Teachers Retirement Association, TRA, and the Minnesota State Retirement System, or MSRS. Part of our analysis for each one of the plans administered by these three agencies was reviewing their funding ratios, which, as most of you probably know, simply is the ratio of assets to liabilities. And we found the following. First, we found that the funding ratios that are used to report the financial status of these plans really make them appear better funded than they actually are. The funding ratios are misleading because they do not properly value the assets of the post-retirement fund. Now, again, as Jim Nobles has already suggested, the assets are supposed to be valued on the basis of a market-related value. But, and this is according to the governmental accounting principles. But instead, the value of the post-retirement fund assets is not market-related. Actuaries assume that the assets of that fund equal its estimated liabilities, even though we know that as of mid-2006, the assets for the fund are actually $4 billion less than the liabilities. Now, this is done in large part, because of the actuarial standards that Jim Knowles alluded to. The Legislative Commission on Pensions and Retirement require that the actuaries set that post-retirement fund's assets equal to the estimated liabilities. And there are some statutory ambiguities that also add to this problem. When we looked at the actuarial valuations for the statewide plans that were completed as of the middle of 2006, we found the amount of their unfunded liabilities, which is their deficit, and we found the funding ratios, which of course are intended to portray what the financial status is of those plans. This table that I'm bringing up on the slide shows what's reported as the financial status for the three largest of the statewide pension plans. If you look, for instance, at the first row, we illustrate the largest of the plans managed by the Public Employees Retirement Association, and that plan, which has most of the local government employees as members, has a deficit of $4.2 billion, and it has the lowest of the funding ratios among the statewide plans at 75%. Now, the legislature made changes back in 2005 and 2006 that would change the amounts contributed by both the employers and the employees to bring the funding of all these statewide plans up to full funding or nearly to full funding by certain dates that are set in statute. And the final column in this table shows you the target date at which these particular three plans should reach full funding or near full funding, given the contributions that are expected to be made due to the legislation passed in the last 2 years. Now, the problem with this table is that the funding ratios there only tell us part of the story. As we said earlier, the market value of those post-retirement fund assets is not used in calculating the funding ratios. And as a result, the reported funding ratios, those that you'll find when you look at the actuarial valuations conducted for those pension plans, make those statewide funds appear better off than they really are. So if the funding ratios of those pension plans were based on the market-related values of the post-retirement fund's assets, those funding ratios would actually be 6 to 10 percentage points less than what is reported in the actuarial valuations. This table shows you that difference. Again, I'll point you to the first row where we illustrate the funding ratios for the Public Employees Retirement Association general plan. And as I said, in its actuarial valuation, the funding ratio is listed at 75%. However, if the share, that plan's share of the post-retirement fund deficit were to be included, that funding ratio actually drops to 68%. And you see a similar drop for each of the major statewide plans. Now, the legislature has made changes in the last couple of years. None of these changes, however, will offer a remedy for this post-retirement fund deficit. Last year, the legislature passed a 5% cap on increases to retirees' benefits. This cap will go into effect in the year 2010. And we think this cap will help avoid future post-retirement fund deficits. I mentioned briefly earlier that in 2005 and 2006, the legislatures passed changes to the amounts that will be contributed to each of the pension plans. And those amounts will bring those plans up to full funding or near full funding by those target dates I already mentioned. However, remember that those contributions are assets for the active employees, not the retirees. So those are assets that are going into the active employees' basic funds, and they do not affect the assets that are in the post-retirement funds, which is where the $4 billion deficit sits. So none of these legislative changes will affect that $4 billion deficit in the post-retirement funds. Now, besides the problem with the deficits, we also looked at the formula used to increase benefits for retirees, and we found some problems there. We found three problems. First, the formula as it now stands helped to create the deficit that's in the post-retirement funds. Now, the formula increases benefits when investment returns are high. Those increases become permanent. The thing is that it doesn't reduce benefits when the markets perform poorly. By not retaining enough earnings in those good years to offset the bad years, the downturn years, the formula actually puts the fund at risk for developing these deficits. The second problem, the benefit increases have not been well aligned with inflation. You may know that the formula used to increase benefits for retirees has two parts to it. One is based on inflation, and it's capped at 2.5% each year. The second component is based on investment performance. So if the markets are strong and investment performance exceeds the amount that's needed to pay retirees' pensions, then the benefits will increase by that amount. Now, this graph on this particular slide shows that the benefit increases have not been well aligned with inflation over time. And I would point you specifically to look at the period roughly between 1997 and 2001 on this chart that shows you the great strength in the benefit increases compared to fairly low or moderate inflation changes. In that period of time, benefit increases exceeded inflation by 3 to 9 percentage points. So we have those two problems. The benefit formula helped to cause the deficit. The benefit formula is not well aligned with inflation. The third problem is that the formula helped to create some inequities between cohorts of retirees. The value of the benefits for some retirees who retired at certain periods, specifically in the 1990 or mid-1990s era, they grew far more than the benefit increases for those who retired in 2000 or after. Now, one of the reasons is that the benefit increases for the retirees averaged 9.2% every year from 1996 up through 2001. But after that, employees who retired after July 1st of 2001 saw benefit increases of just 2.5% or less every year since then. Plus, we know that that 2.5% increase will apply into the future, and probably for a long time into the future, because any benefit increase is limited to just that inflation component as long as a deficit persists in the post-retirement fund. Now, we have three recommendations related to the post-retirement fund. First, we think to properly reflect actual financial conditions, the legislature should require that the funding ratios for the statewide pension plans that are administered by PERA, TRA, and MSRS should reflect the true condition of the post-retirement fund. Second, we think the legislature should develop a plan that will fully fund the post-retirement fund. In our report, we talk about a number of options as ways to do that. We don't recommend one specifically over another, but there are a variety of approaches that could be taken. We do think, though, at the same time that the legislature addresses the deficit, it should also change the benefit formula. We think that it should replace the investment component of the formula and replace it with an enhanced inflation component for the formula. We think it's important to make these changes at the same time because we think that as a package, these kinds of changes could potentially be more acceptable to both retirees and to their employers. As an example, retirees would be giving up that investment-based increase part of the formula, but in exchange for that, they'd have the enhanced security of a fund that is fully funded, and they'd have a chance of improved benefit increases for the near term. Whereas, as I said earlier, right now, as it stands, they can get no more than 2.5% increase because of that, the way the formula now works. Employers, at the same time, would face a reduced risk of those future deficits in exchange for having to put additional contributions in up front. Now, we still don't know whether a package like this would withstand a challenge if something were challenged in court, but we believe that a package that has these kinds of trade-offs does stand a better chance than would a simple reduction in benefits by itself. There are a number of ways that the legislature could change that inflation component of the formula to enhance it. And one of the suggestions has been to retain the 2.5%, but instead of keeping that 2.5% limited to 1 year, that could be sort of carried forward over a number of years so that if inflation was low in 1 year, the benefit increase perhaps was just 1% because inflation was only 0.5%. But if inflation went up 3.5% the next year, then the benefit increase could go up accordingly. And then over that period of time, it could still stay at the 2.5% cap that is now in statute. But there are other ways it could be done as well. Now, I'm going to move on to the second part of this report, which has to do with the other post-employment benefits, and that's primarily the health care for retirees. We found that overall, retiree health insurance and other post-employment benefits, besides the pensions, are not offered in every jurisdiction around the state. And I'll get into that more in just a moment. Although we do not yet have estimates for the liabilities in all communities around the state, we do know that there are liabilities that have been estimated by actuaries for about 24 jurisdictions. And that amount adds up to $1.5 billion in liabilities over the next 30 years. Now, these non-pension benefits, which are known as other post-employment benefits, can include dental coverage or long-term care insurance, vision coverage, other packages, but primarily it's health care for retirees. And in fact, in 2005, across the state, the spending on these other post-employment benefits, 99% of that went to health care insurance. So clearly that's the leader when you talk about other post-employment benefits. Health care insurance is the big eye. Now, there are issues related to the other post-employment benefits that are coming to a head now, in large part because of what Jim Nobles suggested earlier, and that is that the Governmental Accounting Standards Board has a set of requirements that is coming into effect to determine how much of liability is out there for public employers across the country. The requirements that apply to these retiree benefits are being phased in now over a three-year period. They begin this year for the largest governments, and then by 2009, we'll know what the full liability is for jurisdictions around the state, jurisdictions of all sizes. The accounting standards require public employers to have studies that are conducted by actuaries every other year, and these actuarial evaluations will estimate what the liability is for each of these jurisdictions that offer other post-employment benefits. Now, I said, though, that they're not offered everywhere, and I'm going to talk more about that now. In a 2006 study, the State Auditor's Office estimated that about 1 in 5 local governments offered other post-employment benefits in Minnesota. On the chart I have on this slide, you can see that school districts and counties were by far the more likely of the jurisdictions to offer these other post-employment benefits. Cities and special districts, just a relatively small proportion of them offer these benefits. Now, among former state employees who are not reflected here, these are just local government employees and school district employees, among the former state employees, only a few groups are eligible for state-paid health insurance at retirement. The State Patrol, some correctional officers, and a few others. They amount to about 5% of the total state pensioners, number of state pensioners. So, it's, again, for state employees, it's just a small proportion eligible for the benefit. Most jurisdictions that pay for other post-employment benefits do not pay it for all of their employees, nor do they pay the benefit for the retiree's entire lifetime. On the other hand, most of them offer it only to certain employee groups, and they offer it only until the retiree reaches Medicare eligibility, which is typically at age 65. Similarly, most public employers do not pay the full amount of the health care premium. They pay a portion of it, or they'll pay an amount up to a certain cap, but most of them do not pay the full amount. Now, we looked at local government's annual spending, what they spend on everything to provide their services in a given year, and we looked at what portion of that was spent on other post-employment benefits. Most of them spend less than 1% of their total spending on these kinds of benefits. But we found that 11 cities and school districts around the state, all of which were located up in northeastern Minnesota, spent more than 5% of their total spending on these other post-employment benefits. And one even spent up to just under 13%. As I mentioned earlier, the liability for the 24 jurisdictions where we already have actuarial valuation completed amounts to $1.5 billion. We estimate that the amount will roughly double by the time the actuarial valuations are completed for the remaining jurisdictions around the state. We found that about 26% of local governments that pay for the other post-employment benefits have begun to set aside money that will pay the benefits that are now accruing. Statewide, though, the amount that's set aside is far less than the total liabilities in those communities. Now, public employers are not required to reserve money for these benefits, but there are advantages to them to do so. For one thing, if they set aside the money, it means that, of course, the funds will be there when the portion of their workforce that approaches retirement age does retire and the benefits have to be paid for. And for another thing, it means that the current taxpayers are paying for services being provided currently instead of pushing off these costs onto future taxpayers. We learned that most jurisdictions do not now have plans to reserve money in advance for their liabilities, but for those that do want to pre-fund and those that want to be able to reduce their unfunded liability, the standards, the governmental accounting standards, require that they use an irrevocable trust to set aside that money and reserve it. Now, last year, the State Auditor's Office and the Minnesota Attorney General's Office both expressed doubt as to whether local governments in Minnesota have legal authority to establish trusts for this purpose. Because this matter is now in dispute, we think that the legislature should make a change. We recommend that the legislature allow local jurisdictions to establish the irrevocable trusts for other post-employment benefits. We think that statutes should also specify legal title to the asset ownership of the assets, and we think that the statutes should prescribe the fiduciary duties and standards for the trustees who would oversee these funds. We think local governments that establish these kinds of trusts should have the option of having the State Board of Investment manage that money if they choose, but we don't think that it needs to be a requirement imposed on all local governments that might decide such a trust would be beneficial for them. Mr. Chair and members, I'll sum up quickly our report in terms of the findings on pensions. We found that Minnesota statewide pension plans appear better funded than they really are due to that $4 billion deficit in the post-retirement fund. We also found that the changes made by the legislature in the last couple of sessions will not correct that deficit. Regarding the other post-employment benefits, such as the health care insurance, we know there's a $1.5 billion worth of liabilities now, and we think that estimate will roughly double. And about 20% of Minnesota's local jurisdictions, excluding the small townships, do offer these benefits, but only a few offer an extensive package of benefits. To sum up our findings, we think the legislature should require the statewide pension plans to reflect the true financial status of the post-retirement fund. We think the legislature should fully fund the post-retirement fund and change the investment-based component of that formula used to increase benefits. And we think the legislature should allow local governments to establish the irrevocable trusts if they decide they need those trusts to set aside money to pay the other post-employment benefits. With that, Mr. Chair, I'll conclude my remarks. I would mention that we do in our report also discuss the local pension funds, in particular the teacher funds, and we do have findings and recommendations related to those funds, but just in the interest of time, I won't get into those today unless you have questions on them.
Ms. Howard, I've got a question on slides 8 and 9, just so I'm clear. Your recommendation would be, dealing with slide 8 and 9, that the retirees that received from 1996 to 2001 a substantial increase, that would be reduced. Is that, am I correct?
I'll bring up those slides.
And would, am I interpreting your statement to be that they would receive a decline in their retirement in order to level this fund off? Is that where the court challenge comes in?
Mr. Chair, if I understand what you asked, you're asking whether the retirees who are now getting benefits would see a reduction in their benefits?
Yes.
Mr. Chair, that is one of the possibilities, and you're right that a court challenge would almost certainly arise under that scenario. What we're saying is that there is a number of things that could be done, and you'd probably want to look at a variety of things in order to try to, first of all, ward off a challenge, and then secondly, defend the changes if a court challenge should arise.
Yeah, my next question would be, and I don't think you want to answer, do you know what the size of that reduction would be for a typical retiree?
Mr. Chair, no, because that would be something that, I mean, it could vary. It would just vary depending on what other actions were taken. So, no, there's no way to estimate that without knowing what else would be a part of the package of changes.
Mr. Chairman, can I just clarify what your question is? Because, you could be suggesting two possibilities. One would be that retirees that receive some of the increases that occurred because of market performance, that let's say a retiree currently gets $1,400 a month in an annuity, that would be reduced to $1,200. That's one possibility. The other possibility would be that retiree who currently receives $1,400 could have future increases reduced that are currently in law but could be changed so that some of the increases that would occur will either not occur or occur at a lesser amount.
Yeah, Mr. Nobles, my question dealt with your first scenario. Your second scenario, of course, is the other way, that the increases would level off and that no one would receive an arbitrarily higher increase because of an aberration in the market, that there'd be a leveling. Is that correct?
Mr. Chairman, that's correct.
All right. And then I just have one more question. You said the initial problem was $4 billion, and then I'm trying to do some simple math here. Are we looking at 4 plus 3.3 as a number, or what's the total problem that we potentially have here in these funds?
Mr. Chairman, the number you're referring to is the deficits that are in reported right now in the actuarial evaluations for the basic statewide pension plan. And if you look just at both deficits, they add to $6.7 billion. That's separate from the $4 billion deficit in the post fund. The difference, though, is that $6.7 billion deficit has been dealt with, really, by the legislature in the last couple of sessions when it changed the amounts to be contributed by employers and employees. So by those target dates that fall between 2020 and 2037, the deficits that now exist, that $6.7 billion portion that's in the basic fund, should be remedied. So those funds should come back up to full funding or nearly full funding by those target dates, given the contribution levels that are now in law.
Okay, so Ms. Howard, no matter how you look at this, we're looking at maybe 10 to 11 billion.
Well, Mr. Chairman,
with the caveat that there's been a correction on six of it.
That's correct, Mr. Chairman.
All right. And I've asked enough questions. Representative Hilton.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Ms. Howard, what are the total assets of the post-retirement fund?
Ms. Howard.
What percentage of the assets of the post-retirement fund does this $4 billion deficit represent?
Ms. Howard.
Mr. Chairman, Representative, I know we have the number in here. I can tell you that the portion that is represented by the deficit is about 8%. Am I right? Dan Jacobson is my colleague and worked with me on this report.
Well, welcome to the committee, and please identify yourself for the record.
Yeah, my name is Dan Jacobson, and I work for the Legislative Auditor's Office. Mr. Chairman, the Minnesota Post Retirement Fund has assets of $22 million and liabilities of $26 million as of July 2006.
Representative Hilke?
Mr. Chair, million dollars or
a billion? Billion. Sorry.
Well, Mr. Chair, Ms. Howard, if I'm understanding this correctly, the reason for this deficit is market performance.
Ms. Howard.
Mr. Chairman and Representative, yes, in part, we think that it's largely attributable to that benefit formula and the way it works, because, as we said, when the markets perform well, it gives large benefit increases that become permanent. They don't go down when the market performs poorly.
Well, Mr. Chair, if I'm understanding this correctly, then it's possible that the deficit could actually be eliminated currently by an improvement in market performance, but that would not change the problem with the formula. Is that correct?
Ms. Howard.
Mr. Chairman, Representative, that's correct. Now, I think one estimate was that if we were to have 11% average annual market performance over 10 years, that we would probably be close to eliminating the deficit, but that, you know, that might happen. But then again, it might not. And I think some of the prognosticators would say it's more unlikely than likely. But no one can, of course, predict what the markets will do. But you're right, that if we did have extremely good performance over an extended period of time, the problem could take care of itself.
Well, I guess that was the part of my question that remains unanswered, is even if the market performance did get rid of the current deficit, would a change in the formula still be necessary to make the fund secure in the future?
Ms. Howard.
Mr. Chairman and Representative, I'm sorry that I didn't address your question fully. You're right, and from our perspective, the formula still has to change, because it will always be at risk of developing future deficits because of the formula and the way it works. Now, that 5% cap I mentioned will help diminish the risk, but the formula as it now stands, because it has an investment-based component, will still run the risk for the deficits in the future.
Thank you.
Representative Peterson.
I think I was picking up, Mr. Chairman, on the same questions that Representative Hilty was saying. And in 06, we saw very strong market performance. The overall market was up 15-16% in 06. Most of that happened in the second half. So part of that deficit could be assumed has been narrowed because of just market performance.
Ms. Harn.
Mr. Chairman, Representative, that's correct.
Okay. But the market theoretically could help alleviate that problem, which then takes me to the next question and where I want to go, Mr. Chairman, and that is the extent of retiree benefits, of the health care benefits. And you talked about the school district, 70% of the schools and 50% of the counties and 11 or 12 small municipalities. Those increases in cost are absolutely more predictably serious than even the market. I mean, the market could make a good run, but those benefits, short of mortality, will just continue to increase at exponential rate. And I would see that almost as a more predictable concern than even the market.
Ms. Howard or Mr. Nobles?
Mr. Chairman and Representative. Well, I think you're right, because we have with the post-employment health care insurance two things happening, really. One is, of course, medical inflation. And unless the employer has made arrangements so that the benefit, the employer's liability for that benefit has been capped, and some of them have done that, but not all, we have the potential that the employer will be picking up all those increased medical costs for as long as the retiree remains eligible for the benefit. Besides that, the other component to that is the number of the proportion of the workforce that is approaching retirement age. In a lot of jurisdictions, that's a fairly significant proportion. And so we're going to have a fairly large number of people reaching retirement age and becoming eligible for the benefit.
Russell Peters.
Mr. Chairman, can I just comment on the...
Mr. Nobles.
The optimism that exists that the market will go up. The market can go down.
Oh,
the problem can get worse.
I lived through that, sir.
Sim Peterson.
Mr. Chairman, and we all lived through that 7, 8, 9 years ago when the portfolios evaporated, and I would guess some of this deficiency that we have now is part of the evaporation of market value that we saw, somebody have to help me with the dates, but about 8 or 9 years ago. But let me go back to the insurance piece. And if, you know, it would seem to me that you could evaluate, extrapolate what that deficit is going to be as it grows. And then you take the next step, which says there has been talk about legislation to bring school districts into the statewide system. And if you do that, and they are carrying with them this virus, if you please, that exacerbates the problem. We have a pandemic in our state health insurance program because of this thing we're carrying. I'm not saying it very well, but can we deal with, can you help me put those two in perspective?
Mr. Jake.
Yeah. Mr. Chairman, Representative Peterson, when the actuaries made their estimate for the liability for other post-employment benefits, they did take into account their estimates of future growth in health care expenses.
So part of the deficit, and you talk about in slide 13, and the extensive benefits, part of that is a pro forma projection going out, again, given your mortality tables and the age of the retirees, and et cetera, et cetera.
Mr. Jacobson?
Representative, that's correct.
Ms. Howard.
That's the estimated liability that the actuaries arrived at based on all those factors.
Okay. Mr. Chairman.
Representative Pearson.
Now, take it one step further. If we, as a state, were to adopt a statewide health care for teachers, as has been talked about, does this liability that's out there that you're talking about today, does that come into our system? Who assumes that liability? That's the better question. Whose liability is this? If the county of Hennepin gets to a point they simply can't afford it, that's Hennepin County's problem unless we make it ours?
Mr. Chairman.
Ms. Howard.
Representative. And that's correct. Right now, these benefits are laid out in bargaining contracts or personnel policies of the local jurisdiction. Mm-hmm. And also, of course, the state of Minnesota, as I mentioned, has them as well. So right now, it's both employers who bargain those contracts or set out the personnel policies who are responsible for the benefits.
But, Mr. Chairman, could I just
say,
I think we would all agree it's already your problem because you fund through a lot of aids to local units of government, to money to school districts. That money is fungible. It's used for a wide range of purposes. So I think this is already all of our problem.
Representative Pearson?
Yep. Thank you. I think I've abused my time already, Mr. Chairman. I appreciate it. I'd love to keep this conversation going and get a couple of us to join in with me, but I may get to a place I don't want to be.
Representative Peterson, I think you've enlightened us, and we have a couple who want to join in. So, Representative Brown.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I just have two questions, Ms. Hauer. I'm wondering, I think I heard you say that only 5% of local governments have the post-employment benefits. Did I hear that correctly?
Oh, Mr. Chairman.
Ms. Hauer.
Representative, I know it's somewhat larger than that. I think you were remembering the number I talked about for state employees who retire and become eligible. About 5% of current state pensioners are eligible. Among the local jurisdictions, it's about 1 in 5 local jurisdictions, excluding the very smallest townships. So right around 20% if you exclude those small townships, because most of them don't have employees. About 1 in 5 offer the benefit.
Representative.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Thanks for clarifying that for me. My question really goes back to one of your recommendations that we allow cities or provide cities the legal authority for the irrevocable trust. Can you just give me a two-minute primer on the dispute that's out there? You said that there's a dispute out there. I'm just curious about that.
Ms. Hauer? Representative, the dispute boils down to, is there in the statute authority to local governments to set up these trusts for this purpose? And the Attorney General's office opinion was that no, the authority does not now exist. Now, I would add to that that some local jurisdictions have disputed that and have set up some trusts. I don't think the matter has yet resulted in a court challenge, but so the dispute is there or is there not legal authority? We think that we should just clear up the dispute by granting authority to those who want to establish an irrevocable trust.
Representative Brett. Representative Nelson.
I guess that's one of the questions I have here. Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Having to do with irrevocable trusts, and you had talked about statutory ambiguities. Is that part of the statutory ambiguities that is the irrevocable trusts? Or?
Well, Mr. Chairman,
Ms. Hauer.
In part, when I used that language about ambiguities, I was actually referring to that on the pension issue, but I think it's probably apparent here, too, that we just don't have it clearly stated in the statutes that the authority exists to establish the trust for this purpose. So that's what we're asking the legislature to do.
Representative Nelson.
I guess then the other question I had about the irrevocable trust is, if in the future these irrevocable trusts become overfunded, I mean, say we have to have... We've had companies in the past that when the stock market was doing great that came and raided their pension funds. Who would that money belong to? Would that belong to the retired employees, or would the money go back to, if they were overfunded, to the cities, counties, municipalities who set these trusts up?
Ms. Hauer. Representative, I don't know the answer to that question. What you're saying, I think in essence, is if we were above 100% funding ratio for a community that had set up one of these trusts, what would happen if that money was no longer needed? I don't know the answer to that. I don't know what the legal answer is to that question. Although, of course, there are times when pension funds are also above 100%, but that changes over time as, as the other assumptions that go into those estimates change. So mortality changes, number of retirees changes, et cetera.
Representative Nelson.
Mr. Chairman. Another question I wrote down here, so you're going through your presentation, you talked about the cities that had a high percentage of a high percentage of the cities were the ones up in northeastern Minnesota that had large liabilities. Is this based on the size of the cities, or is it based on the extraordinarily high benefits that they're giving to their employees? I mean, is that why they're having more problems there, or is it just the size of the city and the scope of the number of employees they have and the number they have retired?
Ms. Hauer?
Mr. Chairman and Representative, we looked at what we called extensive post-retirement benefits, and by that we meant, do they offer to all employees? Do they offer for the full lifetime of the employee? Do they offer to dependents? And do the employers pay the full full premium? And we found that a fairly large percentage of communities that were in northeastern Minnesota that offer the benefit do have the extensive package. That's not limited to just northeastern Minnesota, because I think that particular reference was to the amount of spending on the benefits as a percent of their total spending. So if you look at what they spent on everything for providing all their services in the year and look at what their percentage was for just these benefits, a large percentage of those who were among the higher in that range happened to be up in northeastern Minnesota.
Representative,
I guess that goes to my question. Is that because they're smaller cities and so that the larger percentage is based because they have smaller budgets. It's the dollar amount makes is bigger because of, or looks bigger because they're smaller cities, or is it because, like I said, again, they have proportionally higher benefits that they're giving out?
Mr. Chairman and Representative, in this case, it's because it's a proportion of their total spending, it's the result of the fact that they've got a fairly extensive package of benefits.
So then it's like the school districts that they're talking about, that when they're talking about having a percentage of their budgets being spent in different areas, that a smaller ones have trouble meeting that, because if you have one high-priced person, a superintendent, and you have only 100 students compared to a high-priced superintendent and 10,000 students, that percentage is going to be out of whack because of the size. I guess that's what I'm getting at.
Ms. Howard or Mr. Jacobs?
Mr. Chairman, Representative Nelson, in the Iron Range school districts, they are facing a decline in student enrollment, and that is making the problem worse because they have an unusually large number of retirees per student compared to other school districts around the state.
Mr. Chairman, could I go back and just answer a little bit the question on what would happen to money left in the irrevocable trust? You know, these are legal constructs created by the legislature, and as long as your action did not abrogate any obligations of local units of government to pay benefits, I think any reserve funds would be subject again to the actions of the legislature. But obviously, if you abrogated any contractual obligation to pay, there could be litigation. But if you didn't, that money could be used for other purposes. But I think it would have to come back to you for that authorization.
Representative Nelson, you have a comment?
Yeah, I guess the question that I guess when I was thinking of that question, I was thinking back to the 90s when the stock market was doing great, and a lot of companies looked at the amount of money that was in their pension plans, and they went after and captured that, and they converted pension plans into different type of plans, lowered the benefits to some employees with the effect of that, and captured that money and then used that for a lot of different reasons. And so ongoing, that has caused some problems some of these companies. But I guess that's what I'm looking at with these irrevocable trusts. If they were to set them up as local municipalities, and like I said, and then we hope that they become overfunded. We get, you know, everything goes great, and there's extra money there, so they don't have to come back and put more money in them. But who would that money belong to? And I guess that's the question. You're saying this, you don't know. I guess that's the answer I'm getting here.
Mr. Nobles?
Well, Mr. Chairman, Representative Nelson, I mean, it is still public funds, subject to the will of the legislature. And again, as long as you don't abrogate obligations that are created to individuals who would have a cause of action against the city or town, school district, I think you would have reasonable grounds for action, legislative action, to use that money or authorize the local unit of government to put that money.
Thank you.
Representative Sandman.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. How typical or atypical is this departure from GASB standards as compared to other states? Are we out on a limb here?
Ms. Howard.
Mr. Chair and Representative, I believe we're the only state that has a post-retirement fund arranged the way we do. I'm not correct about that.
Mr. Jacobson.
Mr. Chairman, Representative, there are some other states that do have, probably the most common arrangement is to have one fund where for both retirees and active employees. I believe Wisconsin has some kind of arrangement whereby they monitor the investment performance and allow that type of increase. So they also may have some type of post fund, but it's not common.
Representative Simon.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. So can you give us a little bit more sense, and maybe the full report does this, but how did this come about? If, as I'm understanding what you're saying, we are atypical and that we're perhaps the only state that's departed in this way, how did that come about?
Ms. Haar.
Mr. Chairman and Representative, I think it does come largely from the actuarial standards that the Legislative Commission on Pensions and Retirement adopted. because in those standards, the actuaries are required to set the assets of the post-retirement fund equal to the estimated liabilities. And as Jim Noble suggested in his earlier remarks, we think that that's just because of the way the post-retirement fund was initially set up. When an employee retires, the asset leaves the basic fund and goes to that pooled post-retirement fund. And at that point, assets do equal liabilities. It's just that over time, that you're going to longer.
Erickson Kim.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Just want to pick up briefly on Representative Peterson's dialogue here. Can you describe the anticipated increase? Can you rough figure the anticipated increase over the annually of health insurance costs?
Ms. Hauer?
Mr. Chairman, Representative, are you talking about premium increases, or I'm not quite sure that I understand.
I guess I'm...
Representative Kim.
I was honing in on premium increases, but I guess I'm overall liability. You mentioned that... I think you understand. Thank you, Ms. Hauer.
Yes, Mr. Chair and Representative. In terms of the overall liability, we did an internal estimate to arrive at what a statewide liability would look like, and we estimated that to be around $3 billion. Now, there's a lot of uncertainty built into that because we didn't take the same steps that an actuary would in arriving at an actuarial estimate of the liability. We based that on what was actually being spent on other post-retirement benefits in fiscal year 2005. We know with a great deal more certainty that the $1.5 billion that has been actuarially arrived at is out there. But as I said, that's for a limited number of communities. But from the data we do have available to us, we think that will about double. It could be a little bit more than that doubling. It could be a little bit less. But we think that at the time that the rest of these actuarial evaluations are completed, which will be within this upcoming three-year period, we can see that, as I said, roughly doubling for a statewide estimate.
But, Mr. Chairman, I think one of the greatest uncertainties is what will local units of government specifically do to control the growth of these benefits. These are negotiated benefits. And some of you may live in communities. I live in St. Paul, for example, where this has been a very controversial issue. And the former mayor spoke very strongly about restricting benefits in new negotiated settlements. So these are going to be decisions made community by community as to how far into the future these benefits are going to be extended and to whom. I mean, now, some of this has been suggested that these are benefits only for the employee, but there are some jurisdictions that have extended health care benefits to dependents as well.
Mr. Chair, if there were any range of solutions that either have been or may be put on the table for serious reform of the health care system, from a universal coverage with a single entity paying from sort of pooling, I think maybe starting at the Representative Peterson had mentioned the statewide school district plan, statewide school employee plan, that would affect the liabilities if it were to actually achieve cost control and cost savings. Am I correct in that? If we were to actually bring in these retirees into a program, into a plan?
Ms. Howe? Mr. Chair, Representative, I think that depends entirely on what happens to the benefits that are in the negotiated contract. Would those be grandfathered over? I don't know. Would they be changed as they were transferred over to the new system? That would dramatically affect what the liability would be.
But I think, Mr. Chairman, we would all agree that any reduction in health care costs, therefore insurance premiums, will help this problem. It'll help a lot of problems. It'll help this one too. But no one seems to be able to yet achieve that reduction.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I guess I'm trying to put this into perspective. Today we're learning that there's at least a $4 billion deficit. I'm just wondering, when did the concern begin as far as is there an amount that gets us to this point, or just if you could kind of just talk about in the last few years how this has grown or become a greater problem, or how we're hearing about it now, and at what point perhaps did you raise the alarm? Did somebody else raise an alarm? And how did that work? I'm just trying to understand maybe the perspective of how we've gotten here.
Well, Mr. Chairman, members, you might want to hear from some of the other people. I think you have listed that you're going to hear from some of the pension plans.
Mr. Nobles, we have at least three other people.
And I think you ought to hear from them on this question, because I think they're going to tell you that they've been raising this issue for some time. This isn't a totally new issue. I think it is getting more attention because of the report that the Office of the Legislative Auditor is released yesterday and is presenting to you today. So I don't think it's been a totally unknown problem. It's just getting more attention.
Representative Poppy?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Is there how did it get to a point where it's only now getting this great amount of attention? Do you have a sense of that? Is it because of the amount? Is it because, I mean, I guess I'm trying to figure out who should oversee this to say, wait a second, this really is the time to, you know, ring the bells and sound the alarm and say this is a concern. So, again, maybe just if there's somebody, I'm not saying that there's someone to blame necessarily, but is there someone where that could have been a little bit louder in raising the alarm?
Mr. Nobles.
Well, Mr. Chairman and members, I think, and this may sound a little immodest, but I mean, I think it shows the value of doing an evaluation from a more independent arm's length basis of some of the issues that are given attention by a lot of people in the legislature and in the executive branch. I mean, we're issuing a whole range of reports on a lot of different subjects, from prevailing wages just to liquor regulation. And I mean, that's what we do. We go into areas where there are other people addressing those concerns, but we issue public reports that get a fair amount of attention. We don't pull punches, you know. We lay the facts out. We put out our recommendations. Some people like them. Some people don't. So that's what we do, and I think, frankly, this report simply shows the value of having that function.
Mr. Nobles, was this one of the reports that we requested? You periodically give us a list, and we rank order a series of them, or is this something that you were going to do regardless of what we had requested?
No, Mr. Chairman, this is one that you requested. The legislature requested through our topic selection process that was authorized by the Legislative Audit Commission.
So, members, this is another example of when they do give us a list of topics, how serious it is to consider how you want to rank those topics for a report to the legislature. And I think that answers, in part, Representative Poppy's question. We requested that you look into this, and this is one of the reports that we had actually requested. I thought that was the case, but... Representative Morgan, you have a question.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I think just a couple of clarifying questions, because a lot's been talked about here, and I don't want to get things confused in my mind. As I understand it, there is a concern about post-retirement fund and pension plans. Is that correct?
Ms. Howard.
Mr. Chairman, Representative, yes, because of the deficit and some of the problems with the benefit increase formula.
Representative Morgan.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And then there is a second concern about retiree benefits for local governments, school districts, cities, counties, and so forth. As well. Is that correct?
Mr. Chairman and Representative, yes, just because we know that there are some liabilities out there and we think that the liability will increase over the next 3 years as we have a better handle on what the actual estimates are.
Representative Murray.
And then finally, it's my understanding that those are two separate concerns that don't have any overlap. One does not affect the other, even though they are both concerns. Is that correct?
Ms. Howard.
Chairman and Representative, that is correct.
Thank you.
Do we have any more questions for members? If not, I do have people on who wish to come up. And, thank you very much. And please stay. We may want you to come back. The first group is Dave Bergstrom, Executive Director, Minnesota State Retirement System. or do you all want to come up at once? Okay, why don't you all come up, and whoever wants to go first, welcome to the committee, and if you'd identify yourself prior to your testimony, that would be great. Welcome.
Good morning, Mr. Chair. My name is Dave Bergstrom, and I'm the Executive Director of the Minnesota State Retirement System. We decided to come up because there's safety in numbers, so we figured all three of us would come up together here. I think I will start today, and then each of us will take different sections so we don't duplicate efforts. And we're passing out a handout as well. We feel the OLA report is very helpful and supports the policy direction that has already been pursued by the legislature and the boards of the three statewide retirement systems. While the post fund is a significant problem, we don't by any means think it's a crisis, and we will give you some of the history today as well as to how we got here and why we're here. And I think I also want to make it clear, quite bluntly, that we were never hiding anything. Last year, the last 2 or 3 years, we have pursued putting a cap on our post-retirement increases of 5%. And that was passed last year during that time in front of numerous Senate committees, numerous House committees. We shared with the committee members the deficit, the steps that we are going to take, and openly discussed that. We've discussed it in our newsletters, and we are very supportive of the accounting changes recommended by the legislative auditor. The boards now, having taken care of the first step of putting a structural change on the post fund of capping at 5%, now want to look at funding sources for that if indeed the investment earnings don't grow us out of the problem. So we are continuing to look at this and have been continuing to look at it. What we'd like to do is probably take just a step back to put some of these things in perspective. And if you would indulge us in that, we would appreciate that.
Mr. Bergstrom, technically we're to be out of here at 9:30. I can stretch it a little bit, just so you know.
Mr. Chair, we're not asking for that much indulgence.
That's right. So,
first of all, I thought what would be helpful if you would refer to the handout is who we are. There's a lot of new people on the committee. I'm with the Minnesota State Retirement System. We cover state employees, University of Minnesota employees. If you include our deferred compensation plan, we have about 127,000 members. Those are active members. We've got about 15,000 members who have left their money in the plan and eligible for benefits someday. And we're currently paying about 35,000 benefit recipients. We have many different plans that we cover. Most, and I won't go through all of those. We also administer the deferred compensation plan. MSRS has assets of about $10 billion, and we're talking about billions today, and I think we need to keep in perspective both sides of the equation, the liabilities and the assets that we have. PERA covers city and county employees, non-teaching school employees. They have the largest active membership of 158,000. They, too, have about 40,000 people who have left the system and eligible for benefits someday and have 66,000 benefit recipients. TRA, Teachers Retirement Association, covers teachers of state universities, community colleges, public schools, and charter schools. They've got about 80,000 active members. They're paying about 45,000 benefit recipients. If you notice on the bottom, PERA has $16.7 billion in assets. Teachers Retirement has $17.8 billion, so we have $44.5 billion in assets. The next page talks about where do we get our money. We get most of our funding, actually, from investment returns. The employee contributions represent about 13% of the revenue source that we have, employer contributions 15%, and 72% comes from investment returns. And that's an important piece of a pre-funded retirement plan. We are not like Social Security. We pre-fund our plan with contributions from active employees and employers, and we get that investment earning working for us. If you look at the expenditure allocation, about 94% of our money goes to pay benefits for retirees, 3% to people who take their money and cash it out, And then investment expenses of our expenditures represent about 2%, and expenses 1%. The example is in error. We will give you a different sheet, so I won't cover that today. But what I really wanted to focus on is where our money comes from and how it is spent. The importance of investment return is critical to any public pension plan. If you look at page 3, last year, ending June 30th of 2006, we had a 12.3% return. This fiscal year, we're halfway through it. We're having another very good year, and hopefully we can continue that. Over a three-year period, we earned 13.2%. In the five-year numbers, in the 10-year numbers, you can see the impact of the negative markets a few years back that we all remember without too much fondness. And we had a 6.4%. And I think what really is important is looking at long-term. Over a 25-year period, we've exceeded 11% returns. And so, again, we're in a long-term business. We do think the post fund is a significant problem, but at this point, not a crisis.
I'm going to cover the post-retirement
fund. Could you welcome to the committee and just please identify yourself?
My name is Mary Batty. I'm the director of PERA. And on the next page, you'll see a schematic of the post fund. But in response to an earlier question, just a little history. In 1969, the legislature created what was known as the Minnesota Post-Retirement or the Minnesota Adjustable Fixed Benefit Fund. And the purpose for creating that was that retirees were very concerned about whether or not the money to pay their benefits was going to be there. So the decision was made to create this fund. In 1980, that fund was reconstituted as what we know as the Minnesota Post-Retirement Investment Fund. And the way in which it pays benefit increases has been modified from 1970 to 1980 and then in the early 90s to the current formulas that we use. Each of the retirement systems transfer money to the post fund when one of our members retires. And that money is there to fund their benefit for their lifetime, assuming the state board will make 6%. So we don't transfer 100% of the value, but it is fully funded with the assumption that the state board will earn at least 6%. The assumption that they will earn 8.5% then covers the guaranteed increase that we pay equal to inflation up to 2.5%. And then above an 8.5% return when the post fund is over 100% funded allows an extra investment piece to be paid. It's one-fifth of the excess market value in each year, and those one-fifths then add to one another. If you go to the second page, the next page, you'll see the effect of that formula. What happened between 94 and 2000 is that the markets were very strong, and the one-fifth excess market values that started to accumulate not only generated substantial benefit increases, but also moved the post fund to 120% funded by the year 2000. In 1999, for those of you who are new and those of you who need a refresher, the retirement systems, and Mr. Vicker did propose, Mr. Vicker from the State Board of Investment, did propose that we needed to address the five-year allocation of those excess market values. We encouraged a movement to spreading those over 10 years, so we retained some of that money in the fund. But there was not a lot of will to make that action. And as you can see, with the fund being 120% funded, there was not a lot of concern that we had any problems ahead of us. However, the markets declined in three consecutive years. So in the first year, we moved down to a 97% funded level in the post fund in 2001, which caused us some concern, but it was the first year of that drop. The following year, it went down significantly more to 81%. We were then quite concerned. That's when we started talking about what are we going to do about this. But our first step was to anticipate what can we do to the formula going forward. So in 2004, we started meeting with our boards and came to the legislature in 2005 with a proposal to, at a minimum, cap the benefits for the future at no more than 5%, the 2.5% inflation guarantee plus an additional investment component up to 2.5%. We were hopeful at that time because you can see that from 03 to 04, we increased the funding in the post fund by almost $1 billion through the investments earned by the state board. But over the last couple of years, although we've had higher than an 8.5% return on investments, we've remained fairly level and continue to have a $4 billion deficit. We have been working with our boards on this issue for several years. We did share this concern with many of those who were in the legislature in 05 and 06 as we visited about the 5% cap. And I do remember that we cautioned that we were cautiously optimistic that we would grow out of this through investment performance, but that we were monitoring it very carefully with the expectation that we may have to come back and address this issue further with the legislature. And so the auditor's report is a culmination of a lot of discussion over the years and now provides us some reinforcement that we do need to move forward with this.
So, Ms. Vanek, which of the proposals by the legislative auditor do you agree with as a solution? And this would go to any of the three of you.
Mr. Chair,
do you support any of the solutions that they have to remedy the situation?
Mr. Chair, the boards have already taken the position. We do support the accounting change. We think at a minimum that needs to be addressed this legislative session. Our boards have formed a joint committee, the first meeting of which will be held this week, to look at other options on funding the post-fund deficit or how we will proceed. Included with that would be what can we afford to pay and what is a reasonable post-retirement adjustment going forward. We are a little concerned about an enhanced cost of living adjustment because that does increase costs to the plan when you guarantee something more than the 2.5% we are currently guaranteeing. So we still have a lot of details to flush out, but we do recognize that we need to do something to change what we currently provide.
That's helpful. Continue, please.
I'll just correct that. My name is Laurie Hacking. I'm with the Teachers Retirement Association. To echo what Mary said, our boards have been at work on this. Some of the analysis, which is the next page that I'll refer to, that we started, because some investment started this summer. And what you see on this page is one of the options displayed, which would be to combine the active fund with the post fund again, recombine those funds so they're one. As you can see, these numbers are similar to what you saw in the auditor's report. Our funding ratios would change, they would decline, and let me just briefly go through those numbers. For MSRS, their current funding ratio is 96.2%, and their required contribution rate is 10.1%, leaving them with a very slight deficiency of 0.1%. PERA has a roughly 75% funding ratio with a total required contribution rate of 12.9%. And actually just a slight sufficiency, I'm sorry. And TRA is at around 92.6% funded with 12.1% contribution rate required and a slight deficiency. They underscore that these numbers assume full implementation of the contribution rate increases that you have already approved. So that's an important thing to underline here. We discussed the deficit in the active funds earlier, and in a sense, they are taken care of by actions that you have already put into place. So moving down below that dark line, combining the funds, you'll see that our funding ratios will decline somewhat if we are to assume that deficit in the post fund and put it all into one fund. However, we would say we think that that problem is still relatively manageable, at least with respect to MSRS and TERA. TRA, however, is in a situation where they would have somewhat of a deficiency of 1.7% of payroll that we believe would have to be addressed. So put this in context, again, this is not a crisis situation. It is a relatively manageable problem, but some some hard work yet has to be done to both figure out if more money is needed, if so, how, and also, most importantly, what will we replace the current post fund adjustment mechanism with? Determining future increases for retirees is a difficult topic and one that the joint boards want to work with all the constituency groups, retirees, active, so that when we come to you with a proposal, hopefully by the next legislative session, you will not be met with a lot of controversy and countervailing opinions, but we'll have something that should be acceptable to most parties concerned. So I will round that up there and just attached to this is information about our distributions of benefits by county. And last, a letter that we recently sent earlier this year before the auditor finalized the report, you know, recommending that these counting changes be made.
Representative Nelson.
Mr. Chairman, I guess the question that came to my mind when you're talking about the CRA, is this made worse by the combining that we did last year of bringing the Minneapolis teachers into the TRA, or is this, would this have been the similar numbers if that hadn't occurred?
Which of you would?
Mr. Chair, Representative.
Ms. Hankey.
When TRA assumed the liabilities of the Minneapolis Fund, contribution rates were increased sufficiently to finance that, those liabilities that we were assuming over a 30-year amortization period. So the package that you passed was financially appropriate in that there were funds made available to us to help take on that deficit. However, I will mention that at the time we came into the merger discussions with a sufficiency. We had excess funds. Mm-hmm. And some of those excess funds were used to help the Minneapolis problem. Had we not done the Minneapolis problem, there may have been some more excess funds here to deal with. But what you enacted or what you adopted last year was financially appropriate.
Thank you. Representative Wolfing.
Chair members, you know, I am concerned about this, and I guess my biggest concern is, as a freshman, I came into this session with people talking about, yippee, we got a surplus, you know, let's spend the money. And as you're detailing this, you know, I don't feel as though we have the money. You know, and it feels like this surplus and what's being laid out by the governor and what we're already starting to talk about in other committees feels false. Because we have, you know, what appears to be a very serious situation of at least $4 billion, if not more. So, I mean, I'm really struggling with how you're trying to balance this and say we're not at a crisis or, you know, don't be as concerned as it looks, et cetera. So I just want to say I'm very, very concerned about this.
Mr. Bergstrom.
And we have concerns as well. I mean, we run a pension plan with billions of dollars that thousands of people are counting on. And we don't mean to downplay it. But if we could look at MSRS and that chart that we just looked at, to me there are two measurements that you look at from a pension plan standpoint. What is the funding ratio? And are the contributions going into it sufficient to get us where we need to be? If you look at MSRS, And we'll look at the bottom part, where we take that post-fund deficit, our share of that $4 billion deficit, which is probably about $500 to $600 million, and we add that to our active funds, our plan is still 92.6% funded, which is very solid from any measurement of a pension plan. In addition to that, if you look at the contribution rates that we have in place, we do not need any additional contributions, assuming we meet all of our expected returns. And that is a very good place to be in. If you look at PERA, they have a slightly lower funding ratio, but they are on track to get those plans back up to full funding over a period of time. And as Lori alluded to, teachers' retirement has to look at an increase in contributions.
So while there is a concern, we have to remember we're in a long-term business. We have sufficient, for at least two of the plans, money coming in to fund them without additional contribution raise at this point. And I guess that's part of the message that we're trying to send.
Let's see who's next. Representative Simon.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And for any of the testifiers, if you go back to the previous page, or at least what I think is the previous page, the one with the two tables or charts on it, or graphs, I guess. I know we want to talk about the future, but I think I'd like to talk just for a second about the past, just as a way of understanding what we might do going forward. Both of these tables here seem to depict one, I guess, boom and bust cycle. The boom of the 90s, the bull market, and then the downturn around 2000-2001. But I'm curious, as obviously this type of thing has happened before, in the 80s, for example, in 1987, there was the crash. How did you handle this before? This has to have come up before in other cycles, and I'm wondering whether you know how this was handled. Did you just grow your way out of the problem when the next bull market came around? Obviously, this isn't a new phenomenon. I'm just wondering how, if you know, this has been handled historically.
Ms. Fanning?
Mr. Chair and Representative, the formula that shared excess investment gains at market value of the fund went into place in 1992. In the 80s, the post-retirement fund formula was driven by actual returns, realized income. So what happened over the decade of the 80s is a portfolio of half stocks, half bonds diminished to over about 86% bonds as stocks were sold off and capital gains were realized to make sure that the money was there to pay the benefits. So it was actual earnings on the fund that generated increase in the 80s. In the early 90s, which the formula was changed to guarantee inflation plus share in market gains on the fund. And so we didn't experience the same phenomenon in the 1980s, although we did shrink a billions of dollar portfolio from stocks to bonds and weren't getting the earning power that we should be getting on that fund.
Representative Stein?
Okay.
Representative Winkler?
Thank you, Mr. Chair, to the testifiers. So I'm trying to understand your position on the recommendations from the legislative auditor. And as I understand it, you do agree that the accounting standards should be changed to provide, as they say, appropriate disclosure for deficit. On the second point, the second legislative auditor recommendation is to fully fund the post-retirement fund. And your position, if you'll correct me, is that the 25-year growth of 11% annually would largely take care of this problem. Is that correct?
Mr. Bergstrom?
Mr. Chair, I don't think it has a possibility of taking care of the problem, but we cannot rely on that. So what our boards are looking at are very much the same as the alternatives that are laid out in the legislative auditor's report. One of the alternatives we're looking at is combining the active fund with the post fund, and then changing how that formula mechanism would work. Another alternative would be to set up some contingency funding into that fund if, for example, the post fund didn't work. So as an active plan reaches 100% funded, we could then set up a contingency. We really need to look at the mechanism that we're using. The auditor recommends tying it closer to the rate of inflation. And we are not uncomfortable with that concept, but we do have to be careful going too high, because even if you tie it to inflation, and inflation is 10%, we could run into the same issue that we have in front of you. So what our boards are doing are really studying the same alternatives that the legislative auditor has laid out in their report.
Mr. Chair, just one follow-up point. So on the third recommendation from the legislative auditor, which is to change the formula for benefit increases, is it so you are under having discussions and studying what those changes might be, and that you don't necessarily believe that the legislative auditor's specific proposal is the only viable approach?
Mr. Bergstrom.
Mr. Chair, that's correct. I mean, there are other alternatives, and there are a lot of details. As Mary mentioned, in 1999, we came up when we were quite frankly, sitting on a big pot of money. And we tried to spread those gains and losses over 10 years, and we made a very big mistake. We did not do our legwork selling it to the various groups. We rushed ahead. We thought it was good. We still think it was a good process, but it did run into opposition. What we want to do is make sure that when we put the formula in this time, that it works. We've really had three post-retirement, different post-retirement adjustments since this was created. In the 1970s, we put in a post-retirement increase that didn't yield a single increase. So that didn't work. In the 80s, we had an increase, as Mary mentioned, moving us all to bonds, well, in a long-term investment. That didn't work. And then when we decided to set up the current mechanism, we just could not, I don't think anybody could anticipate a huge market run-up followed by that sharp of decline. If it was the ups and downs, it would have worked fine and we weren't here. So really, throughout those three changes, we ran into unanticipated consequences. We don't want to come in with a proposal to do that again. And we want to make sure the actuarial numbers work. We want to make sure our various stakeholders are supportive of this. So we'll be looking at many different alternatives, including the ones that the auditors laid out.
Thank you.
Sen Olson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
If I could, Mr. Chair, I just wanted to comment on Representative Poppy's points earlier, first time. Representative Poppy raised a good point, a question about where this came from. And I, over the years, have remembered this quote numerous times from a previous chair in the late 90s when the bill was first presented to us at that time. It said, if you believe pensions should be more dependent on stock markets, then it was a good bill. He further stated, if you plan to be here in years for years into the future, it's not a good bill. To the comments earlier by the testifiers, it was a well-known fact that we had problems coming. And to, begging your pardon, Representative Wolfslager, is that right? Okay. Wasn't sure if I remembered it right. I, too, think we have extremely serious concerns. This is just one in a series. It's not just a problem, but it is a very serious concern. Over the summer, I found an article from a conservative source. I have very few sources of information that I fully trust, and I always try to check it with other sources. I found an article that identified our country as literally currently being bankrupt, and I took that to House Research to an economist, a professor, and asked them to check and verify the numbers and verify the sources, and they did. And we are in very serious financial times. So I appreciate the comments and the questions, and I think we need to take a even more serious look at this than what's being presented. Thank you.
Representative Peterson.
Just quick question. Where do we go from here? I remember when my daughters reached adulthood and they would come to me with this great big dilemma, and then I couldn't deal with it because I couldn't ground them. Where do we go? I mean, now that we've had this dropped on us, where do we go with this? What happens?
Representative Peterson, I think what you're looking at now are the suggestions that have been made by the legislative auditor and the suggestions that will come forth from these three groups. I anticipate there will be legislation this session that will begin to resolve these problems. That's why we have this hearing, and I think we're going to have more hearings on it. Representative Peterson.
And just as a comment, I'm always very fearful of a dilution solution. And if this combining somehow dilutes those who are strong to benefit those who are weak, I'm not sure we're addressing it. And I just would ask your boards, I'm cautious of a dilution solution.
Well, Brickson,
whatever that means.
Brickson Peterson, I don't think we have the resources to do anything else but be cautious. Brickson Kim.
On that note, I'm going to again join in the conversation started by Representative Peterson both before and now, and that is just to say that I think that absent in the written recommendations, but certainly I think we heard verbally a minute ago from Mr. Nobles, is the concern over the cost of health care. And I think it's a way to avoid diluting, I think addressing the crisis on health care and health care costs is a way of diluting and lowering standards, and rather a way of reducing costs and maintaining the quality of benefits that we provide, that you provide to our retirees. And I just wanted to note that it was that though it was absent in the written report, it was certainly addressed in testimony and should be a part of the conversation, and certainly we should carry it forward as legislators this session.
Members, I have one other person that wishes to testify, Education Minnesota, so if they want to come down and testify to the comments that have been made by the three groups. Welcome to the committee, and if you'd identify yourself for the record.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, my name is Jan Allspiker, and I'm with Education Minnesota. I'm just briefly going to lay out some things for you to consider. We understand that there are issues with the post fund and that it does need to be fixed. So I want to lay out something for you. In the teacher's retirement fund, when a teacher is actually teaching, the money goes into the active fund. Once a teacher retires, it then goes into the post fund. And the retiree's earnings are paid from the post fund. What you are seeing today is that the active fund is really doing quite well. And the post fund is the fund that has a deficiency. And so I'm just laying this out to you so that you have all this information that some of the teachers are going to be concerned about. If you combine the post fund with the active fund, what you are doing then is having the active members pay for the deficiencies that were caused by the high increases that some of the retirees received. And I only lay that out there so that you have all the information. Now, I'm not saying that you absolutely shouldn't do that right now. We might have that situation later, but I think it's an important thing for you to consider, especially if you look into the auditor's report. If you turn to page 69, they compare public pension plan, there's comparisons there, into the initial benefit that teachers receive when they retire. And I won't go through it all right now, but if you read pages 69, 70, 71, and on to 72, and you compare Minnesota teacher plans benefits with teachers in other states, you will find very clearly, it's very stark, that Minnesota teachers compared to other states, only 34 states because they're coordinated with Social Security, they're the only state that doesn't have a way to retire before the normal retirement age. In other words, like a rule of 90 or 30 years and out. And that's for the majority of our teachers. That means, and they have a higher than normal retirement age. Their retirement age is age 66 or 65, depending on which tier they're in. There isn't any other state that is that high. Their penalties are higher if they retire early. They are taxed at 100% of their benefit is taxed at 100%, and that's only one of a few states that are. So there is a real need to increase the retirement benefits for teachers, and our concern is if you take this active fund and merge it with the post fund, it makes it more difficult to get teachers in Minnesota just to average. If we could get Minnesota teachers just to average, that would be good. And we don't have that future possibility of the average of 9.6% increases for the retirees now, because it was capped last year at 5%. So those concerns aren't there. We'd be willing to talk to anybody. We've been talking to the pension funds about how to fix it. Oh, I do have to say, in one area, Minnesota is at least average, and that's the employee contributions. Employer contributions are way down. And so it really is time to fix the teacher benefit calculations. Thank you.
We have a question. Representative Olson.
I'll pass for time. Okay. Thank you.
Any other questions? Thank you very much. Members, any other questions on this topic? Mr. Shepard, as I understand it, the Pension Commission will be dealing with most of the legislation that comes to this committee. It's dealt with at the Pension Commission. We will then get a bill back from the Pension Commission that we can deal with. Is that correct, or do you want to explain the process here? This is in part to Representative Peterson's comment on what could happen.
Mr. Chair, members, yes. This committee traditionally has deferred its consideration of pension legislation until the Legislative Commission on Pensions and Retirement puts together a bill. On the two topics that the auditor presented today, one of them, the health insurance for retirees, traditionally has not been deferred to the Pension Commission, has not, because that is not, strictly speaking, part of the pension fund. So this committee has traditionally considered that topic without waiting for the Pension Commission.
So, members, there will be a bill before us at some point that deals with pensions and, in all likelihood, the issues that we have discussed today, and that we can deal with as we wish. Representative Olson.
Mr. Chair, to that process, if and I'm not asking you to answer this now, but I just ask that you would consider, given the seriousness of the policy implications of many of these provisions in these bills, and the difficulty in making some of these decisions, you consider not trying to address this kind of a problem in an omnibus bill, but to leave more policymaking ability for the committee and the body to take some of these more difficult decisions and let them go on their own.
Representative Olson, we will be as deliberate as we can.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
All right. Members, we're running out of time, and we have one more pension that can present. I don't know if they can do it in about 5 minutes. Is that possible to do that, or should we wait until tomorrow, Mr. Noble?
Mr. Chairman, maybe I can just sum up what that's about, and then you can decide if you want us to come back. Again, this was a topic that the Legislative Audit Commission asked us to look at, and that is pensions for volunteer firefighters. Now, the state auditor normally audits those and does audit those and receive reports. As you know, the state auditor has jurisdiction over local units of government, and this is a function of local government, although there is state money put into these pensions. But from time to time, you ask the Legislative Audit Commission to authorize a topic where there are broader policy issues, not just financial audit issues that would be covered by the state auditor. The state auditor doesn't do the kinds of evaluation work that we talked about this morning. So last year, the Legislative Audit Commission, in response to requests from legislators, asked us to look at some of the broader issues, structural issues, about these pension plans. There are 700 of them that cover 20,000 volunteer firefighters, and they're in virtually every community. I'm sure you have many in your communities. What we were asked to look at is, should these be consolidated into one state-managed pension fund? We decided not to make that recommendation. We think there really is some value in local control. Communities really care a lot about these pension plans. And so we do not make a recommendation for centralization of the administration of these plans. But we do recommend that this money be invested through the State Board of Investment, that these pension plans be required to bring that money to the State Board of Investment for investment purposes, because our analysis showed that they are receiving, on average, significantly less return than they could if they invested through the State Board of Investment. But that's what that report is about, Mr. Chairman. It is more of a local government issue, not quite sure of the committee jurisdiction. We are going to be presenting that report to the local government committee, but we would be more than happy to come back at some future date and present it to you as well if you're interested.
Members, is there a feeling that we should hear the report? I don't think it's going to be much longer than what Mr. Noble's just presented, but we can certainly do that if you wish. I see no great desire here to have another piece of Representative Hilde.
Mr. Chair, Representative Todd is not here this morning, but I think we would probably find that she has a great deal of interest in this.
Representative Hilde, I have numerous volunteer firefighters in my district. Her name is mentioned quite often. It will be a much longer hearing if she's here. So, Representative Hilty, I'm going to put this on you, so you think we should hear it.
I didn't say that.
Mr. Nobles, I think we'll let local government take a look at this. Tomorrow we have three bills before us, and they've each requested a half hour. And I apologize for the people from the volunteer firefighters. This has taken some time, but this is a very serious issue. So,
And Mr. Chairman, we would certainly be very willing, eager to come and talk to any of you individually who have a concern or interest in the volunteer firefighter pension report that we issued, or you might well attend the local government committee when we make that presentation. So thank you again, Mr. Chairman. I really appreciate your willingness and the willingness of the members of this committee to take on the issue that we did discuss today. As you saw, it's important, it's complicated, and it does need to be dealt with. So thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Thank you. Representative Morgan, you've read the minutes from the last meeting. Do you have a moment?
Yes, I'd like to move the minutes from January 18, 2007.
Representative Morgan moves the minutes of the last meeting. All those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Any opposed? The motion prevails. Members, tomorrow we have three bills before us. Each has requested a half hour. I regret to say that it looks like we're meeting at 8 again. So. And with that, the meeting is adjourned.